I'm Julia Paskin. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. That's April 25th at the Crawford. Tickets at las.com/events.
From the Moen Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. The Bobcat Fire has searched over 100,000 acres burned, with containment only in the teens. An evacuated resident of Juniper Hills shares her story of driving through charred moonscape to see if her house survived. Plus, California's EDD is hitting the pause button. Find out why you won't be able to make an unemployment claim for at least 2 weeks. It's ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez, thanks for being with us at the start of the week. Coming up,
every picture that I made during the administration, all 1.9 million images, are now at the National Archives. And in due time, they will all be made public.
Conversation with the White House photographer to President Obama and President Reagan, Pete Souza. New documentary about his life and his work is out now. That's coming up later in the show. But we start today in Juniper Hills, where the Bobcat Fire continues to threaten homes. Now, it's burned more than 100,000 acres, still only 15% contained. And officials say the fire is one of the largest ever in L.A. County, and it's not yet clear how many homes have been lost because of it. Juniper Hills is one community that's been affected, and Robin Rosenthal is an artist and documentary filmmaker who lives there. She evacuated last week and starts by telling us about the community she's lived at for 20 years.
Very, very close-knit. I mean, that's, you know, one of the most obvious things that's happening right now, the sort of we're all in this together vibe. There are artists up here, there are retired people up here, there are people, you know, involved in agriculture, people have horses, people have livestock, fruit trees, you know, there used to be a lot of orchards here.
So, Robin, how is your home doing? Have you heard anything at all about how it's doing?
We have actually seen it. It is fine. It looks like there was quite a firefight out our backyard. Our house sits on 5 acres, and then there are 15 rolling acres of hill and arroyo out to the east. A large part of the fire came down the mountains more on the eastern edge. So when we got a chance to see it yesterday, we saw gigantic treads from bulldozers had come in and basically stopped the fire at the edge of our flatter backyard.
How relieved did you feel when you saw that?
Extremely. I mean, I can't even tell you, because what we were driving up through was devastated. Although it looked like the houses, for the most part, had been saved, we were really relieved to see a lot of homes standing, but the just charred black and gray ashen landscape was shocking, and our hearts sank. Everything's pretty much dirt road on the inside this asphalt loop. So we got onto the dirt road and everything looked fine. And we happened to look out the back and saw, oh my God, they made a stand here. So, and that's what they seem to have been doing, you know, at most of the houses. We do know of probably 20 or so houses gone in Juniper Hills itself. I'm told it's in the dozens. I don't know that anybody has a final count, and I don't think it's quite over.
Robin, considering that you've been through this before with the station fire, is this still a community that you'll want to stay in?
Probably more so because of the response that I'm seeing from neighbors. Just before I got on this call with you, we were, you know, heading down to do this interview where I could have cell reception, and we saw smoke coming from a place that it seemed a little more than just the low to the ground smolder that we've been seeing. And so we drove in to see what it was, and we were about to call somebody, and along came a guy on a tractor. There's these just people from the community just going around and putting out hot spots. You know, it's the kind of people who don't wait for other people to do for them. You know, they're organizing all kinds of, you know, water pickups and hose gathering and things that people might need. So it makes you really grateful to live in a place like this. It's pretty special here.
Well, Robin, it's good to hear that your home survived. That's Juniper Hills resident Robin Rosenthal. Robin, thank you very much.
Thank you, A. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
For more on the Bobcat Fire, we have KPCC's Sharon McNary. Now, Sharon, we've just heard from Juniper Hills, but what about the status of other nearby communities? I understand that areas to the north are now being threatened.
Yeah, right. Juniper Hills, Devil's Punch Bowl, and Paradise Springs, those are the communities immediately below the mountains, most in the path of the fire. But to the east there is Wrightwood, which is why that community is on an evacuation warning right now, not a full mandatory evacuation right now. If the fire continues north, communities in the flats of Antelope Valley could be in the path of the fire. It's already jumped Fort Tejon Road, and they're trying to keep it south of Pear Blossom Highway. But there are a couple other areas of concern. On the west side of the fire, it's approaching Little Rock Reservoir west of Highway 2. It's making a run from Highway 2 toward Big Tahunga Road, if you know that area. There's an area called Barley Flats Trail. It's this very difficult hike from Highway 2 over to Big Tahunga Road. And Camp Colby in that vicinity has been warned to be ready to evacuate. Mount Wilson, of course, was declared safe over the weekend. And then it had a flare-up on the north side. So the Battle of Mount Wilson might not be over yet. And then the Adams Pack Mule Station at Chantry Flats on the south and east side of the fire, it survived. But there was another flare-up down in Santa Anita Canyon, where there's a number of privately owned cabins on U.S. Forest Service land, and also areas along the East Fork of the San Gabriel River may remain evacuated.
So Sharon, how equipped are firefighters to be able to keep battling this one?
Well, there's 1,700 of them on the Bobcat Fire right now, all told, and they're equipped as well as any professional full-time firefighters in the U.S., but keep in mind that there are fires burning all over California. So when they ask for more strike teams to protect clusters of homes or more aircraft, there's only so much to go around. Like, I was listening to scanners last week. I heard requests for more, more, more that just couldn't be met.
You know, we always think about the physical toll that this takes on firefighters, but emotionally, too, it's got to just tear them up. And I know that a firefighter on the El Dorado fire near Yucaipa has died. How does something like this, Sharon, really just impact firefighters?
You know, firefighters are always getting safety messages, situational awareness messages from their bosses and their peers and their crew leaders. And the death last Thursday of a hotshot firefighter has to have redoubled that messaging. But you got to think, you know, these are human. And so firefighters have to be asking themselves if they're taking the right risk with every move. Can they get, you know, down to looking at a house in the path of a fire and triaging whether the owners have sufficiently prepped it with enough brush clearance and defensive space to help them keep the flames away.
Now, if anybody's been outside, Sharon, they know that it is definitely not as hot as it has been for the last few weeks. Is that one positive, Sharon, that the weather might be cooperating with the firefighters this week?
If you're looking for a positive, yes. Yeah. The weather will cool down through the middle of the week, and that's the good part. Humidity is still low in just the single digits, though, so that'll continue to dry out the brush and make it more apt to burn. The winds should be moderate, about 20 to 30 miles an hour, way up on the ridgelines and less down below.
Stepping back for a second, Sharon, this has come to be one of the largest fires in L.A. County's history, but it's been unusual in the way that it's burned. How has that been?
Well, it is a really big fire, 5,000 acres, that's 164 square miles. The footprint puts it in the top 20 or 30 or so of California fires by size. But it's an unusual burn. I mean, usually we see most homes lost in the early days of the fire. This fire went for nearly 2 weeks before it got to homes in that populated area. And it's still far from the most destructive of homes or lives. Nobody's died in this fire. And while we know that some homes in the Juniper Hills area have burned, officials haven't done the work necessary to eyeball the damage and come up with a specific number, because that calls for personnel they can't spare from the firefight right now.
That's KPCC's Sharon McNary. Sharon, thanks a lot.
You bet.
All right, moving on. Since the pandemic began, California's Unemployment Development Department, otherwise known as the EDD, has been plagued by delayed unemployment benefits and fraud. So Governor Gavin Newsom created a team of government and technology experts to look into the agency's problems and propose some fixes. Well, that was back in July. On Saturday, that team released a report with some recommendations. And while now it implement some of those suggestions, the EDD said it will not be accepting new unemployment claims for the next 2 weeks. For more on the report and the latest, Katie Murphy joins us. She's a reporter with Politico and has been following the story. Now, Katie, we know the backlog in unemployment claims persists. Can you tell us what the report says are the department's biggest issues?
Where to begin? The report found that the system is doing an excessive amount of manual claims processing, that 4 in 10 people who apply for unemployment get flagged, sometimes for minor things like middle initials being off or middle names being a little different. And so those 4 in 10 people will just languish in the backlog, and the people that are able, that have enough experience in the department to be able to kind of sort through this and get to the bottom of it, have been redirected to train up the new hires, hundreds of new people that the department has hired. So they, you know, the team recommended that they automate a lot of the identity verification that's really gumming up the works. And that's what they'll be working on over the next couple of weeks.
Now, on Saturday, the unemployment agency announced it will not be taking new claims for the next 2 weeks, in line with one of the strike team's guidance. Can you tell us why the reset button? Why now?
They said that and this affects people who are filing for the first time. They're saying that if we didn't do a reset and we just proceeded as normal, 4 in 10 people would be flagged for this, you know, get stuck in this backlog. And we don't want that to happen. So we're taking a reset. We're implementing this commercially available ID tool. And then when people are able to apply, many, many more people will be just automatically have their claims automatically processed.
That ID tool, is that a short-term fix or is that a long-term fix for EDD?
That is a short-term fix. EDD is also dealing with very archaic IT systems, and they've been trying to replace this for many years, and claim that they're in the position that they were planning to do so this year, and then the pandemic struck. So in the long term, they need to modernize their systems. But this is a short-term fix that the strike team says will drastically reduce the backlog. Although that said, there are still 1.6 million people who are either awaiting their first payment, or they initially got a payment and then they had their benefits turned off because of some certification problem. So it will take now until the end of January, according to the EDD director, to go through this backlog.
Now, the report referenced cases of fraud being partially to blame for the backlog. You've been looking into this a lot more. Can you tell us how significant of an issue this is for California's unemployment agency?
This is a huge issue for California and for states around the country. And California has been working with federal investigators. It looks like there are some sophisticated crime rings that have taken people's stolen identities from recent, the Equifax hack and other breaches, and they're using that to steal people's, sometimes change bank account info or to log in and change, to take over people's accounts. So it's a big issue. But what the strike team found was that EDD has been very preoccupied with the fraud, but what's happening is they're not actually catching the fraudsters. They're just slowing people's payments. So whatever methods they've used to try to root out the fraud hasn't really worked. And instead, it's just really hurt ordinary people who are waiting for their benefits.
One more thing really quick, Katie. We've heard from many people, and you mentioned all the people that are just sitting there waiting for their first payment, and we've heard from a lot of them. Can you tell us how the strike team plans to address the delays in the payments?
Well, they say that if you are on the automatic track, and there's no, you're not flagged for fraud or for some discrepancy, you will get paid within the 3 week, you know, the normal 3 week time frame. So their whole plan of attack is to get as many people as possible on that track.
All right, that's Katie Murphy, reporter with Politico. Katie, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
More Take Two coming up in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and online through the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Every week, we talk about the headlines out of Orange County with Nick Gerda, reporter at the nonprofit news site, The Voice of OC. Nick, welcome back.
Great to be here, eh?
All right, tensions. Tensions are mounting all over Orange County, various school districts in Orange County, where classes are set to resume over the coming weeks. So first, Nick, bring us up to speed on the push to get school back in session.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of back and forth on this, and basically the state has given the go-ahead for all school districts in Orange County to reopen in-person classes starting tomorrow, as long as they follow certain rules around masks, spacing out desks, etc. But it's up to each school district to decide when they'll actually open, and it's pretty much all over the place. There's 28 different school districts in Orange County. Many of the largest districts are waiting until October or later to reopen in person. Those districts are based in Santa Ana and Anaheim, where coronavirus infection rates are higher than the rest of the county. But other districts are looking to open up in person in the next week, including later this week. Those districts include Saddleback, Irvine, Tustin, and Fountain Valley Unifieds. And some of those districts are facing intense pushback from parents and teachers. Irvine Unified is supposed to start in person on Thursday of this week, and teachers there are calling on the district to delay the return to campus until next semester. They put together an open letter that's gotten over 2,000 signatures of support from teachers, students, and community members. They're saying that reopening in person would jeopardize the safety of students, staff, and families, and they're pointing to a lack of a regular testing program as risking potential outbreaks on campus that could spread into homes. The school district officials in Irvine are saying the district's been preparing for months for this to reopen, and that they've been working closely with parents and staff and students and medical professionals to do it in a safe way. But on the flip side, there are concerns about students continuing to stay home for months on end, and issues like long-term effects on the mental health of students and social development. And there's worries about unequal access to online learning. Some students don't have reliable internet at home or don't have someone available to help navigate through education apps. So a lot of the schools are having to balance all these different issues.
Now, on the other side of the spectrum, there are parents who are not just worried that reopened schools will lead to more cases, but what they see as a lack of transparency by the county's health department if there's an outbreak on campus. Tell us about that.
Exactly. It's both an if and a when, since it's already been happening. Some are worried that rushing back into in-person instruction would cause a spike in cases and more deaths. And it's really unclear right now how much transparency there's going to be about it. My colleague Spencer Custodio has been reporting on how the OC healthcare agency is still keeping virus outbreaks secret in Orange County. That's a different approach than LA County, where the county health department is posting info on outbreaks at schools, like how many people were infected at which schools. Orange County's not doing that at this point, and that's driving part of the concern about the school reopenings locally. Some of that was on display yesterday. There was a car caravan in Costa Mesa to protest school reopenings in Newport Mesa Unified, and protesters were holding up signs saying more safety and planning are needed, and that schools should only open when it's safe.
All right, so let's change gears here for a second. In recent weeks, the LA Sheriff's Department faced criticism for a lack of honesty, in part because of an incident regarding one of our own journalists. Those issues are now playing out in the same way in Orange County with their Sheriff's Department, as you report, because of charges filed last week. What happened there?
Yeah, so there's a lot of questions about the OC Sheriff's Department and potential honesty and integrity lapses within some of their deputies. There was a series of felony charges announced earlier this month against deputies, including for falsifying police reports. There were arrests and charges against a deputy for burglarizing a home, another for stealing from a shoplifting suspect, and another for falsely stating in a police report that methamphetamine was booked into evidence when it actually wasn't. And it's the evidence claims and the statements about evidence that are drawing the most attention. There's been an ongoing issue coming to light of multiple deputies that did not book evidence and then made false statements about having booked it. More than 30 deputies have been referred for possible criminal charges. Three have been charged so far, so possibly more to come as those investigations proceed.
The last week and a half, Nick, we've been getting a lot of information about oversight for the LA Sheriff's Department, but I'm wondering for Orange County, what's the oversight process there, and what have county supervisors said about this?
Yeah, so from my understanding, LA has kind of an oversight commission, a civilian oversight commission. Orange County does not, so it largely falls to the Orange County Board of Supervisors and their appointed watchdog, the Office of Independent Review. And the watchdog, I spoke with him last week, and he said he is concerned. He credited the sheriff for looking into these matters, but that this does point to a concern about possible honesty and integrity issues in the department. So he's going to be taking a look at that. As far as the supervisors, who are sort of the civilian check on the sheriff's department, four out of the five would not comment on the recent charges. The one that did said that he hoped to see more training of deputies to make sure that they're getting the appropriate training they need.
All right, one more thing, Nick. We're going to wrap up by looking at Anaheim, the finances there, which officials there last week said the city is hemorrhaging money because of the theme parks that are closed. So how bad is Anaheim's financial outlook?
Yeah, so this is something the mayor of Anaheim, Harry Sidhu, has been really pushing hard on to try and get Disneyland reopened. A lot of concerns about potential of outbreaks and infections. And as far as the city's financial position, they do get tens of millions of dollars in revenue from the resort district every year. So they're looking at a big financial hit. Now, about half of that money does go back to the resort district, doesn't end up in the city's funding for services. But the city's really pushing to get Disneyland reopened. But a lot of the unions are concerned about worker safety for such a large gathering of people.
Now, in just a moment, we're going to get more details on the Disneyland situation with Robert Niles from Theme Park Insider. But Nick, tell us about the talk over a bailout of one of the city's departments for tourism called Visit Anaheim.
Yeah, so this was earlier on in the pandemic. The city had a decision to make on what to do to support local businesses. And rather than spending a lot to support small businesses, they ended up putting $6.5 million towards the marketing lobby for the resort district. It's called Visit Anaheim. And it was very controversial at the time because Disneyland was closed and would likely be closed for several months. So a lot of people were pushing back on the idea of putting so much general taxpayer money to promote basically a theme park that was going to be closed for a while. The city said it was a smart investment and they're standing by their decision. That's been really a center of a lot of public debate and comments in Anaheim in the last few months.
That's Nick Gerda, reporter for Voice of the OC. Voice of OC. Nick, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Abe.
All right. Anaheim is not alone. Other cities where theme parks operate are dealing with similar issues. Because their economies heavily depend on those tourist draws, some are trying to put pressure on politicians to have them reopen in whatever fashion they can. So we're going to get deeper into that with Robert Niles, founder and editor of the site Theme Park Insider. Now, Robert, around the country, what are some other cities dealing with when their nearby theme parks are closed or maybe have reduced capacities? What are they dealing with?
Yeah, it's been really tough for the tourism industry, obviously, around the world at this point. This is a pandemic. This is not any type of local epidemic. But we've seen a variety of responses from around the country. A lot of the parks in Florida are open again. Parks in California are closed. It's a mixed bag elsewhere, but it's been really tough for all tourism-dependent economies to get that tax base that they're used to when tourists, quite frankly, are, for the most part, staying home.
Yeah, those tourist towns have had their economies propped up for so long because of their dependence on these theme parks. Do you think, Robert, most will be able to survive in some fashion until those parks can fully reopen?
It's going to be tough. I mean, this is the reason why rainy day funds exist when you think about such things. This is a time when leaders really have to step up and get creative because it's going to be a while before that tax revenue starts flowing back in. Even what we've seen in Florida with the parks reopened there, it's severely diminished capacities and very rarely hitting that capacity. Occasionally it happens, but for the most part, The tourist economy is staying home at this point, so there's not a whole lot of money to be had with partial reopenings. That said, a little something is probably better than nothing, and that's one of the reasons why we see things like Knott's Berry Farm doing their food festivals, SeaWorld down in San Diego doing what they're doing to try and get, at least recoup a little bit of income during this pandemic.
I always wonder, Robert, if the cost of just opening, you know, with not as many people as they could have in the park, is it negligible? You know, is it just worth it just to stay closed because it just costs too much to open if you're not going to get a lot coming back in?
Hey, this is where math geeks get their jobs and earn their money. Yeah. I mean, it is an equation you've got to do and figure out. From what we've heard from the people who are running companies, I mean, Bob Chapek has said this, the new CEO at Disney, is that they can run with a fairly low percentage. Mm. I mean, when you think about it, a lot of these parks that are open around the year, I mean, they've tried to boost their attendance during the down season, but there are times where you're talking about a crowd that's 1/5, maybe even 1/10 of what we'll have on a big day like the 4th of July or Christmas. And they're making money on those days. So if you string a lot of them together, it's clearly not as profitable as it usually would be, but they're not exactly running in the red.
Yeah. Now, here in California, there's a push to have Governor Newsom rethink guidelines to reopening parks. So what has he said in response to that?
Well, basically, he keeps coming out and saying that the new guidelines are coming out very, very soon. And he's been saying that for several weeks now. So it appears very clearly that many of us have different definitions of what very, very soon means. Everyone's just kind of waiting for that guidance from the state because nobody can do anything until it gets delivered.
Now, Robert, you know, one of the fun things that I've missed in my life since the pandemic is going to movie theaters. I love going to movie theaters, seeing them in the movie theater, but I will not go back for a while. I already know that about myself. So I'm wondering, for people that love going to theme parks, what's the appetite for park goers to head back inside those gates?
Yeah, we have heard such a wide variety of opinions from our readers on themeparkinsider.com. There's many of them have said, we're not going back until there's a vaccine. Some of them have said, you know, we're kind of comfortable going back right now under the current environment. There are other people who are on the other side of the spectrum who are like, yeah, we feel perfectly safe, but we're not going to go because they're going to make us wear a mask. So it is really the complete spectrum of opinions out there at this point. But clearly the fact that you don't have that kind of unifying force where everybody wanted to go to parks like the way it was before, that just shows how much money is being left on the table at this moment.
Well, that goes right along with something that you wrote about, that no matter what happens, park reopenings have really become a political debate rather than a decision based in public health.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a little unfortunate that the decision isn't being driven here by medical professionals, by people with a professional background in epidemiology who could tell us something about, you know, what's really happening here. And then talking to the people who are going to be on the front lines working there. I mean, those are the voices I think we really need to be centering at this point, not so much the politicians. Yes, Anaheim is in trouble at this point. Yes, a lot of communities are in trouble at this point. Yes, we need to do something. But at the same time, I don't know that selling out health is the thing that we need to do, because we're going to pay a cost for that eventually if that's the way we go.
Yeah, and that's the problem too, right, Robert? If that's how this gets framed, then there's all kinds of dangers, all kinds of the can of dangers gets opened up, right?
Yeah, I mean, the trick here is that Anaheim and a lot of communities can point to the fact that they've got lower case rates. Well, if you're a tourism-driven economy and your tourist attractions are closed, well, yeah, of course you're going to have lower case rates because nobody's visiting. And you've got to look at the consumer confidence that what you have there is safe. I mean, Disney has invested a lot of money in building a very safe theme park. They've invested a lot in Florida in creating very safe operations. The public health people out there have said there haven't been any cases traced back to transmissions within the parks themselves. So, I mean, Disney has a strong case here, but the simple fact is that this is a really complex issue where we need guidance from medical professionals here, you know, not people who are trying to find an easy solution to a city budget problem.
Robert Niles, founder and editor of the site Theme Park Insider. Robert, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, think about what makes the person who occupies the White House look presidential to you. That picture probably was taken by a White House photographer. Pete Souza spent 8 years with both Reagan and Obama. We'll hear from him when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm Martinez. With less than 50 days to go before the presidential election, a new documentary reveals what the job of commander-in-chief actually looks like from the inside, or at least what it looked like when Obama was in office. The Way I See It, from filmmaker Don Porter, tells a story of Pete Souza, the chief official White House photographer for President Obama. Souza had also been one of the White House photographers for President Reagan. Souza has a background as a photojournalist, which informed his work covering the president. And when we reached out to him and Porter, Souza explained his role.
The purpose of the official White House photographer is to document the presidency for history. Prior to LBJ, the office was a military office. Mm-hmm. And the photographers assigned to the White House didn't necessarily have a relationship with the president coming in. And really, it's dependent upon the particular president and his or her photographer on what that means. Fortunately, with President Obama, I had carte blanche to have access to everything that he did. And so I think the archive that I created is pretty rich visually for historians. I mean, I don't think people realize every picture that I made during the administration, all 1.9 million
wow.
images are now at the National Archives. And in due time, they will all be made public.
And Pete, Lyndon Johnson's photographer, you really admire his sense of style, his sense of just being able to take the kind of pictures that maybe you wanted to do when you were working with Reagan and Obama.
Johnson wanted somebody to really document his presidency for history. And he hired this guy, Yoshi Okamoto, who he had met when Okamoto worked for the USIA and had traveled with Johnson when he was vice president a couple of times. And, you know, Okamoto was such a great photographer. Johnson was such an, you know, amazing character. And he gave Okamoto this unbelievable access. And I think Okamoto set the bar so high for the rest of us. I think we've all been trying to reach that level.
Now, Don, in your film, you're documenting how Pete documented President Obama mostly. And within those 8 years, you found many story arcs inside that larger narrative. What are some of those mini stories that you really wanted to tell with this film?
You know, I think Pete's photos help, you know, paint a portrait of how important empathy, compassion, and leadership are. And so, you know, we wanted to lean into those themes. So I think the most, you know, iconic images of the Obama presidency is on the day that Osama bin Laden, you know, was killed. And you see in that photo the real emotion of that room. You see who was in that room. And so you really get a sense of the gravity of the moment, but also the demeanor and comportment of the executive staff that was involved in making that decision to keep America safe. You know, and as Pete points out, that like there's no, you know, celebration at the loss of a life, even a life that had caused so much pain and damage to America. It was a very sobering, serious picture. And I think that reflects the leadership, you know, that was in the White House at that time. So pictures like that, yeah. You know, tell us what's happening behind the scenes with people who are really making life and death decisions for all of the rest of us.
Talking to Pete Souza, White House photographer for President Reagan and the chief official White House photographer for President Obama, and also filmmaker Don Porter, who tells his story in the film The Way I See It. Now, Don, the fact that President Obama was our first African-American president, I think is in part why these images changed the way the world saw who a president could be. And there's one image that Pete took of a little boy, a little black boy, who visits the Oval Office that seems to symbolize a lot. Tell us about that photograph.
Yeah, I think you're referring to the photograph of Jacob Philadelphia, who was, you know, 5 or 6 years old at the time. His parents, I believe, were government employees. I think maybe one parent was a diplomat, I believe. But, you know, Jacob's mom said to the president, you know, Jacob has something to ask you. And Jacob says, Mr. President, my friends say my hair looks just like yours, you know. And at that moment, the president of the United States, arguably the most powerful person in the world, bends over and lets, you know, a small child touch his hair to say, yes, my hair is just like yours. And Pete, you know, will tell the story of he just got one image, you know, it was just a split second. And I think, you know, having the President of the United States understand that how much that confirmation would mean to that little boy, like, yes, he is real. He has skin that looks similar to mine. And you know, I think images like that, they obviously mean something special if you're an African American person like I am. But I think they mean something, you know, to the world, to see that America, you know, a country with so much racial strife, you know, had come together to elect a person, you know, with brown skin and with an African heritage. So particularly right now when we're so divided, being reminded that, you know, we did achieve, you know, this level of equality, you know, once, I think it speaks to the fact that that is in our future, not just our past.
Pete, considering that President Obama's presidency was a first, historic, wondering, as you're going about your daily, day-to-day duties, how much of your head was on a swivel to make sure that you didn't miss any great moment like the one Don just described?
I was always ready for those moments. I mean, that's like, you know, that's what keeps you going, is that there's going to be a fleeting moment during the day and you got to anticipate it and be ready for it. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, that was, you know, and there's a certain pressure to that when you're doing that every day for 8 years. Because, you know, not every day is there an image like that.
Yeah.
But there might be, and you have to be ready for it.
Pete, what do we know about the current staff of White House photographers? I mean, what access are they given, and what are they documenting that you've heard of?
I have no independent knowledge one way or the other. You know, we don't see those pictures, mm-hmm. but, you know, whether there is that kind of access or not, I just don't know.
Don, how much do you think the images that Pete took of Ronald Reagan and Barack Obama influenced the world in how they think a president is or should be?
I think that they are astounding images. And I think Pete really, you know, brought the presidents to the world. It's so few people who have that kind of, you know, personal relationship and personal, you know, are in the physical space of these people. And so Pete's photography is a window into that world. And that's why, you know, I'm also, as an observer, grateful that he brought his reporter's eye, he brought his eye for story, but also an eye towards preserving history, preserving the things that we want to see and we want to know about. You know, there are so many kind of iconic photos, you know, of both Reagan and, you know, President Obama greeting fallen soldiers and injured soldiers, greeting families of people who were, you know, killed in combat, comforting Americans after natural disasters or other man-made horrors. All of those images contribute to how we view ourselves as American, to our social fabric. And I think Pete's images have contributed to that canon in an immeasurable way.
Hey, what do you think of that? Because I'm wondering if in the moment when you were with Reagan and Obama, or maybe after the fact, did you think that I'm defining, or at least helping define, what presidential means?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. You know, Michelle Obama says that the presidency doesn't change who you are, it reveals who you are. And I think that's true with the photographs, too. The behind-the-scenes photographs that aren't posed, that are fleeting, where you see him, the president, interacting with other people. You see how they interact. And I think it reveals what kind of a human being they are in not always pleasant times and making stressful decisions, interacting with world leaders, comforting families in times of tragedy. I think you get a real sense of what they are like just as human beings through my photographs. hopefully.
Dawn Porter is the director of The Way I See It. Pete Souza is the subject of the film. It's in select theaters this Friday and on MSNBC on October 9th. Dawn, Pete, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
All right, if you watched last night's Emmys, the virtual Emmys, did you think for a second that just for a second Jimmy Kimmel was actually standing in front of a huge crowd? Because that's kind of how it looked. You knew he was in Staples Center. You knew he was supposed to be alone. But for a second, did the crowd and all the different shots of the celebrities fool you? It kind of fooled me a little bit just for a second. We'll hear how it all went down when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm Amy Martinez. Last night, the Emmys went virtual. Jimmy Kimmel hosted from a largely empty Staples Center. Winners accepted their trophies from wherever they happened to be in the world, and pretty much all of it went off without a hitch. The pop TV show Schitt's Creek, that's spelled S-C-H-I-T-T-S, racked up a ton of awards in the comedy categories. The HBO drama series Succession and the HBO limited series Watchmen both got a number of awards in their respective categories. So how did Hollywood's first pandemic award show go? And if we still have a pandemic in early 2021, is there anything that the Oscar producers can learn from last night's event? Here to discuss all of this is KPCC's John Horn. Now, John, from an award ceremony point of view, because I know you've been covering these things for centuries. What are the biggest takeaways from last night's show?
Well, you said you watched the show, I watched the show, and the two of us together, I think, added about 20% to the audience size. Not surprisingly, the lowest rated Emmys ever. I think more people watch Quibi than watch the Emmys. Down, of course, from last year, which was the previous record holder for smallest audience. Listen, hosting any award show is hard. Hosting a virtual one is impossible. Jimmy Kimmel tried. I'm not going to grade him, but it wasn't a passing mark. One thing that I think is worth noting is thanks largely to HBO's Watchmen, the Emmys had record wins for Black actors. I think that's really good. I'll tell you the thing I didn't miss, which I hope we can do away with or scale back, and that is the red carpet. All of these idiotic questions about what kind of shoes people are wearing. I don't want to hear about your Tom Ford shoes when 200,000 Americans have died from the pandemic. I can't think of anything more tone deaf or irrelevant or privileged than a red carpet right now. So I didn't miss that, and I hope it is gone for good, even though I know in my heart it's not.
Yeah, but even pre-pandemic, the red carpet kind of feels weird. It's one of those things. Yeah, you're right. We could do without
it. There's an audience for it, but that doesn't mean it's a good thing.
Yeah. And you mentioned how the ratings weren't so great. I got to admit, this show did not keep my attention. You know why, John? I'll tell you why. In the mornings, I'm on a Zoom call with my staff here at Take Two. In the evenings, I'm on a Zoom call. I didn't want to see another Zoom call for 2 hours. Why would I do that?
I get it. And listen, having a lot of the winners accept their awards remotely is different. But here's what I think was important. You watch an award show where the audience is filled with everybody who worked on the show, and they get up there and they start thanking their team, their publicists, their agents, their managers. Nobody outside of that room has heard of these people or cares about them. And that's gone. I think people really adjusted, you know, what they were going to say. And I'm going to cite a couple of examples. I thought the best acceptance speech wasn't Mark Ruffalo's for I Know This Much Is True, where he won lead actor in a miniseries or movie. It was his wife's reaction to what he was saying.
Yeah, that's right.
Sonny Coigny. And the way she was so exhilarated and she was crying, she was pumping her fist. You never see that in a normal ceremony because Mark Ruffalo's on stage and his wife is in the audience. And maybe they do a 2-second cut of her. I thought that was really, really good. And I thought the acceptance speeches largely were really personal. And I thought they were memorable, much more so than what we get typically in front of a live audience, where I think everybody is so focused on thanking the people they work with.
The unthank yous. We had one that
We did.
Yeah, that was, I forget who did that.
It was Jesse Armstrong from Succession, yeah. And he was unthanking, it was the only time President Trump was mentioned. He was unthanking him, and even though he didn't name Fox News, because Succession is about basically the Murdochs, he did unthank Fox News for propping up nationalist and quasi-nationalist
media moguls. That's what he said. Media moguls who do so much to keep them in power. Yeah. All right. And rather than have celebrity presenters kind of just banter kind of in a dumb way all night, some of the people announcing winners were just everyday folks who have become essential workers in the COVID economy. A nurse who had gotten COVID, a rancher, a female truck driver. So what did you make of that choice, and what did that bring to the ceremony?
I mean, I think it really grounded it. I thought it was really good. And in fact, the fact that they found a female trucker was genius. And listen, banter between celebrity presenters as they're going to the mic and talking about their category is painful at best. It's never that great. Sometimes if people go off script and start winging it, it can be good. But to eliminate almost all of that, in fact, I thought the worst moments of the broadcast was when Jimmy Kimmel was bantering with Jennifer Aniston. I thought that was really painful. But to eliminate those celebrity pairings was great, and to see real people who watch TV and care about it was much better.
And that fire that Jennifer Aniston was putting out.
Yeah, she almost didn't get it out.
Yeah, it got a little dangerous there. All right, so John, award shows are often a place where political or social justice statements get made. A few years ago at the Golden Globes, many actresses attended the ceremony wearing black and with activists as their dates. They were calling attention to the Me Too movement. So let's talk about what political statements were made last night. So here's Regina King. She won the Emmy for Lead Actress in a limited series for her show Watchmen.
Have a voting plan. Go to ballotpedia.com. Vote up the ballot, please. Go to ballotpedia.com and find out who are voting in your municipal elections. It is very important. Be a good human. Rest in power, RBG.
Yeah, John, because you know those gowns that they wear on the red carpet can't have messages as cool or as effective as a T-shirt. And that's what a lot of people were wearing.
Totally true. If you're wearing a tuxedo or a gown, you might have a little button. You might have a bow on your lapel. These people, I mean, two people, Regina King and Uzo Adaba, were wearing Breonna Taylor T-shirts. Damon Lindelof, who won for Watchmen, was wearing a T-shirt that said, "Remember Tulsa 1921, the race riot that is not only a historical fact, but starts Watchmen." And it's an eerie scene thinking about what's going on in the country today. So, yes, when you're not wearing a tuxedo, you can make a political statement. And the political statements largely around voting weren't about who to vote for, although I think it's clear what direction people were leaning. It was to the mechanics of how to vote, to get out and vote, how to register, how to get to your ballot place. And it was very instructional. And so clearly there was some sort of conversation about we need to be kind of helpful in getting people out and voting and not so much talking about what the issues are.
All right. So, John, if this could be a model going forward, you think? Because as far as an award ceremony goes, I mean, what could the Oscars possibly learn from this one? Now, I know this is TV. The Emmys are a TV award. Oscars are a different thing. So anything they can learn from this?
Well, I guess they can hope that maybe, and this sounds dark, that the protocols are still in place, because I think the takeaways from the Emmys that are useful, get rid of the red carpet or scale it back. And also, so much of the Oscars or any award show is about the marketing and the events. Schitt's Creek, S-C-H-I-T-T-S, is from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and POP, which used to be the TV Guide Network. It is off the air. It's finished its last season. There's no way they could compete with Netflix or HBO in a regular year for, you know, for your consideration ads. They succeeded, I think, because people are at home and Netflix bought the streaming rights to Schitt's Creek a couple years ago. People were watching it, and maybe it was a meritocracy. Maybe this rose to the top because people watched it and they liked it. It had never won an Emmy before. It won the most Emmys for any comedy series ever last night. And I think that's a reflection of the show itself, not all the marketing and events and money that was spent promoting it.
Can you imagine people liking something just because they liked it?
Yeah, that's why they listen to your show.
That's KPCC's John Horn, host of the LA Studios podcast, Hollywood the Sequel. John, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
All right, if you missed any part of Take Two, just head to wherever you get your podcast. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. We're also on Twitter at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. And that's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.